Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. As London gets set to host the 30th Olympiad, acclaimed sports writer Frank DeFord connects the modern games to their unlikely origin in rural England. He has a fascinating article in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and he's here to talk about the early start of the Olympics and the phenomenally interesting and kind of wacky characters associated with this. Frank, of course, was with us fairly recently when he was talking about his memoir, Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, and his recent article caught our attention, this little-known story of how the modern Olympics got their start. Frank is senior contributing writer at Sports Illustrated, weekly commentator for NPR's Morning Edition, regular correspondent on the HBO show Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. He has written 18 books, and he is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Frank. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always go to our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Just a reminder, hour number two, we have a really good lineup today. Ford is a great guest, and David Marinus will join us. David's latest book, you know, you look at this guy's trajectory, and it's incredible that he became president. It just amazes me every time I read about it. David Marinus spent 4 years and traveled some 60,000 miles all over the world to get the story of Barack Obama and his ancestors. His book is Barack Obama, The Story. He's with us, hour number two. So that's the deal. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for joining us again.
Delighted.
Before we get to England, I was interested in, you write in this Smithsonian piece that the original Olympics were banned in 393 A.D. What happened at that time?
The Christians came in. They took over from the Romans, and festivals were considered a bit too tacky for them. We were a more sedate era. We weren't supposed to celebrate the human body quite so much as the Romans had, and that was the general idea. It's also possible, though I'm not altogether sure, that interest in the Olympics was waning. You know, you could only go so long with a hit. They'd been around for several hundred years and had lost a little bit of their luster. But basically, the Christians thought they were just a little too pagan for them.
But the Europeans, you write, of the Dark and Middle Ages did keep playing their games.
Well, yes. The idea, if you go to any museum, you never see any pictures of the folk, the hoi polloi, playing games. You only see the royals at the hunt, basically, with blood sports, because obviously the painters were only painting the royals. But the fact of the matter is that sports remained with most of the people an amusement that they enjoyed. And it was true in England and perhaps other places as well that often the king wanted people to stop playing games. He wanted them to get out their bows and arrows and practice in case he needed to form an army. Robin Hood is probably the best known athlete during that era with the bow and arrow. Once again, more of a blood sport than anything else. But games never went away. They just sort of went underground.
You start the article with the grandiose president of the International Olympic Committee, who's placing a wreath on a grave in Wenlock, England. Who was he, and whose grave was it?
Well, that was Juan Antonio Cimarron, who was the former president of the International Olympic Committee. Mr. Cimarron, who liked to be referred to as His Excellency, was a pompous ass in my mind and that of a lot of others. I do give him credit for one thing. He got rid of amateurism in the Olympics. He got rid of that hypocrisy. But otherwise, he ran a pretty corrupt organization. He ran it for 20 more or more years. I've always said that it was Peter Uberoth who ran the 19 80 Los Angeles Olympics, who really saved, or the 84 Olympics, who really saved the games, figured out how to do it. And Zamorin took credit for that. But he was, Zamorin was pretty much of a dictator.
Hmm.
But that's what made it all the more amazing that he went to this little town called Much Winlock, which is in western England, very near the Wales border. And there he laid a wreath on the grave of a man named Dr. William Penny Brooks, and said, in effect, that he really was the founder, not in effect, I quote now, really was the founder of the modern Olympic Games. And the reason was that Dr. Brooks, in this little town in the middle of the 19th century, reinstituted on a local level the Olympics. And not only that, the Much Winlock Olympics are still around every year. They have them, and this sort of toy Olympics, if you will. But it was very important in keeping the Olympic ideal alive, and to some extent inspired the modern games.
Hmm. And they're underway now. They took place in July, didn't they? Earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
They're probably going on right now. Just because there happens to be another Olympics down the road in London doesn't mean that the Much Winlock Games aren't going to be held for like the 150th time. Nothing has stopped them except for wars. And sometimes they drew some really great athletes, and they were well enough known in the 19th century that the King of Greece was very impressed that this little town in England was maintaining this Grecian tradition, and sent a cup that was be presented to one of the Much Winlock athletes. So they were well known.
And what kinds of games, Frank, were they playing? Similar to what we'll see in a couple next week.
Similar, but sometimes there were some rather bizarre games, like a pig chase. I remember one year they would have what seemed more like a children's party. But one thing they did have, too, was they had team games, ball games. Very interesting that the Olympics, and I'm talking the original Olympics, never had any ball games, never had any team games, running, jumping, wrestling, chariot races. I guess you could call that a team game to some extent. But ball games were always looked down on, which I really can't understand why. Thomas Jefferson, of all things, called them evil. By the same time, his neighbors were the ones going out and hunting animals, and the Appalachians were famous, not far from Charlottesville, for terrible blood sports, wrestling, gouging, battle royals. But ball games, the upper classes always thought they were, well, if not evil, they did you no good. But the Much Winlock Games incorporated some ball games, and that was really the beginning of modern sports as we know them. It was the British and the English-speaking countries who made ball games the important aspect of athletics, which they are, and they're by far the most important aspect of athletics.
Mm-hmm.
We know that whatever country you're talking about, it's a team ball game, which is the most popular.
Doesn't
matter whether it's soccer, which it is in most countries, or rugby in some places, or cricket, or of course our American football and baseball, basketball.
But don't get you started on soccer, right?
No, it always has confounded me why soccer is so popular. But I don't dispute the fact that it is, and most people adore it. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that soccer is the cheapest sport. I mean, I've seen it being played in the poorest parts of Africa. All you need is the ball made up of rags, and you put a couple of rocks, separate them, and you've got a goal. And so a great part of the charm of soccer is that it is so easy to play no matter where you are. But notwithstanding why, it is the most popular game. But beyond that, ball games are those which people like the best.
Yeah.
And Much Winlock incorporated those games in response to the popularity that was developing. All the ball games were codified around the middle of the 19th century. It didn't make any difference whether it was Australian rules football or soccer or football and baseball in the United States, field hockey, all of them in a period of 20 or 30 years sort of developed. And not only that, then organizations were made, leagues came. The Duke of Wellington made the famous remark, or is said to have made the famous remark, that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of England. Well, it won. He never said that. But notwithstanding, it was in what are called public schools, which are really private schools in England, that these games began to develop. Rugby, for example, started at a school called Rugby,
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I must quote you. I just read your article, so I've got this Thomas Jefferson quote that's in the Smithsonian piece, which is worth saying. Games played with the ball are too violent for the body and stamp no character on the mind. And then you write, talk about over the top. You would have thought Alexander Hamilton was playing shortstop for the Yankees.
Why? Why Jefferson was so exercised with people playing ball games is beyond me. They were pretty benign then. American football hadn't been invented. Nobody was getting concussions around then. Baseball was just developing, called town ball and so forth. And I'm sure somebody was kicking a ball around. But Jefferson much preferred those blood sports that the gentry had always practiced through the millennia.
Yeah. Now go down across the channel for a moment here and tell me who this guy is and his importance in resurrecting the games. He was quite a character as well. I don't speak French. Is it Pierre Freddy from
Freddy Baron de Coubertin? Forget his Christian name. He was Baron de Coubertin.
All right.
And there's no question that he is, without any doubt, there would be no Olympics without Baron de Coubertin. As I explain in the article, he got a lot of help later on, but it was his inspiration. This strange Frenchman with this magnificent mustache, which went well out beyond his cheeks. He was a little guy, and he grew up in the late 19th century, and the thing that had stayed with him, that even though he had only been a child when the Germans, the Prussians, beat the French and beat them solidly and quickly in the Franco-Prussian War of, I think it was 1873, it was also a time when France was losing its prestige in the world. The language of diplomacy had been French, of course, and it had always been looked upon as the most esteemed of countries, and it was losing that prestige. And de Coubertin was convinced, and probably to a large degree accurately so, that the reason the French had lost the Franco-Prussian War is that the German troops were in much better condition, physical condition. And so he was determined to see that would never happen again, and that the young Frenchman would exercise and be more athletic so that should war come again, they would be better prepared. Well, in the process of thinking about this, he came up with the old Olympic ideal. Not only am I going to help our French youth be better exercised, I'm going to raise athletics, as he said, to a position of religion, to a spiritual thing. And that was when he began to think in terms of reinstituting the old Greek Olympics. And it was strictly him, and it became an absolute obsession. He lost all his money. Would eventually, his wife just got bored with him, I think, and left him. he eventually would die in the 1930s, and his heart was buried at Olympia.
Really?
There's no question that de Coubertin, just single-handedly, by, I can't say by the force of his personality, because he was a terribly dull man, but just his persistence, and he would hold meetings, he'd somehow get rather important people to be on his committees, even if they didn't do anything. But he was a name dropper.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very, very good at it. And we now begin to connect him to England because he saw how athletics were really developing in England.
And
much more interesting in England than in Germany. In Germany, the exercises, what had made the German soldiers in better health, were sit-ups and pull-ups and all that dull stuff.
Yeah.
And the British, though, were beginning to play games.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me?
Is it fair to say that de Coubertin was the guy who realized and made possible the Olympics going from place to place, that it had to be, as you call it, a road show?
Yes. Yes, he saw that. When he finally got the Olympics in 1896 and got the Greeks to put them on in Athens, and they were pretty popular there. But their popularity, their notice even, didn't extend much beyond the Greek borders. And the Greeks wanted, hey, we got a good thing here, you know, and let's keep them. And de Coubertin saw that if that were the case, they were going to pretty much be a local institution. And he wanted to move them around. He wanted particularly to bring them to France, which, of course, was his home country. And he knew that if they were going to be a global enterprise, they couldn't be located in just one country, particularly a country like Greece, which by that time was something of a backwater.
Hmm.
I think an argument could have been made that if Paris, for example, or London or Rome had wanted the Olympics as a permanent possession, he might have gone along. But he certainly was not going to let a little country in southeastern Europe keep them, just because that's where they'd started a couple of millennia before.
Hmm. But the Paris ones, you talk about being over 5 months, scattered over 5 months. That wasn't a good idea.
No, he pretty much, again, most people thought he was nutty. I mean, honestly.
Right.
I mean, they thought this guy had this dream, and he was kind of humored. Penny Brooks in Mutch Winlock was one of the few people he found who was of like mind. He went to Mutch Winlock, and he saw these games, and he said, wow. I mean, he could visualize, finally, not just in his mind's eye, but before his real eye, he could see the real Olympics. But most people just sort of humored him. As I say, he wasn't a very attractive guy. He was boring and tedious and single-minded, and so he finally got the games, got Paris to accept the second Olympics in the year 1900. But he had to go along to get them accepted as part of the World's Fair there. They couldn't be held as a discrete enterprise event on their own. And so they got swallowed up. They got completely swallowed up by this World's Fair, the 1900 exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, there were all sorts of crazy events, swimming underwater. I think the firemen, if that's the place where the firemen put out a fire, that was an event. And so most people didn't even know they were going on. You know, you would go to the fair, and maybe there would be an athletic event, but most people didn't even understand that these were the Olympics. They were a disaster, and all the worse that it was his hometown.
Hmm. Frank DeFord is our guest. We're going to go to phone calls here in just a moment. He, of course, is author most recently. He's a very prolific writer. Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer, and an article that he wrote that appears in the July-August issue of Smithsonian Magazine is just fascinating, caught our attention. The little-known history of how the modern Olympics got their start, and that's what Frank is talking about with us this hour. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our show, David Marinus will join us. He has written a book. Actually, it only takes Obama to the age of 27. A lot of the book is about his parents, his grandparents, and his great-grandparents, and the remarkable story of all of these parts from all over the world. It's really such an interesting story. And David is a meticulous researcher and historian himself. All right, let's go to phone calls. Frank DeFord is our guest this hour. We're talking about the little-known history of how the modern Olympics got their start. And Mike in Milwaukee is our first call.
Hi, Kathleen. Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I wanted to say I called in last time about cold fusion and soccer, and I agree with Frank completely. I just wanted to ask Frank, when a sport becomes democratized to include the non-wealthy through government subsidies, corporate subsidies, and scholarships, the pool of participants in that sport is not only increased, but the best body type for that sport eventually emerges and past records shatter. Now, the body type of being a 100-meter sprinter was appropriately muscular, but the sprinter was only about 5'10" tall. Now, along comes Usain Bolt, who's about 6'5", and he shattered the 100-meter record in 2008 in China and ran the last meter or so backwards. So I was wondering, is Usain Bolt the new body type or prototype for the 100-meter dash, or is he physiologically anomalous for the present, and we won't see anyone of that stature winning the 100-meter dash for some time to come? And I'll take any responses off the air.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, I'm not an expert on physiology, but I think we've found that as athletes in almost every sport get bigger and stronger, they do better. Records fall. The running backs in football weigh 50 or 60 or 70 pounds more than they used to just a generation ago, and are better. And so it stands to reason. Baseball players are much larger than they were just a generation ago, and so I think it stands to reason that a sprinter being taller with longer legs is more likely to set the record. Now, the problem with being tall as a sprinter, I do know this, is the start. You got to unwind, and so a tall guy may not be as fast out of the blocks as somebody short and compact. But as the case of Usain Bolt proves, you can make up that distance with your long legs pretty quickly. Now, at some point, I suppose you get too tall. Would Will Chamberlain have set the 100-meter record if he had chosen to run? I don't know what the ideal is, but it's probably around the 6'5 that Usain Bolt is.
You have a couple stories in the piece in the Smithsonian about runners, which I'd like for you to tell us because they're interesting stories. One, and I can't remember the year here, Frank, the marathon, the 26 miles with the candy maker from Capri, who had in the American of Irish stock.
That was the 1908 Olympics.
Okay.
The Olympics which saved the Olympics because just to complete the dispiriting history of the early games, after the failure of the Olympics in Paris in 1900, they went to the United States. They were supposed to go to Chicago, which, of course, was then the second largest city in the country and would have been a logical place for them. But St. Louis was having its World Fair in 1904. Anybody remembers Judy Garland, bang, bang, bang,
of
went
course.
To Trolley?
Meet me in St. Louis, Louis. Meet me at the fair.
Yeah, meet me at the fair. And And St. Louis did not want any competition, and Chicago realized that it would be overshadowed and so forth. And so the games were sent to St. Louis, and St. Louis had really, once it got them, didn't know what to do with them. And it was the same sort of thing as Chicago. They were subsumed by the fair, and they had all kinds of mostly it was just American athletes. De Coubertin didn't even bother to go, and it was a total disaster. And the Olympics were really reeling then. I mean, they'd had two bad ones, and the London saved them in 1908. But there were, as you say, a couple of interesting races. The most famous one, and I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about it, particularly as we approach the marathon, was, and this, by the way, incidentally, is where the crazy length of the marathon, 26 miles, 385 yards, came from.
Mm.
It originally had been 24 miles and something, because that was the distance from Marathon, Greece, the real marathon, mm-hmm. to Athens. Mm-hmm. But Queen Mary wanted her grandchildren to see the start of the marathon. And so it was moved to the palace, to Windsor Palace. And that's how it got the 26 miles, 385 yards. Started right under the window where the kids could look out.
Oh, my gosh.
And it just stayed that way for forever, that bizarre distance. And a little Italian candy maker led, and it just turned out, I know they're having absolutely horrible weather in London now, but on that particular Olympics in 1908, it there was very hot weather, and on that particular day, Marathon Day, it was really extremely hot. It was a bad day to run 26 miles, 385 yards, and this little Italian named Durando Pietri led, coming into the stadium. But he began to, he was woozy, and he turned the wrong way, and everybody is cheering and fearing for his health, and the officials, all British, ran out and grabbed him, and in effect ushered him across the line.
Oh.
Well, no, you can't do that.
No.
You have to finish
guy.
On your own.
Yeah.
And so when the results were examined, he was disqualified. And everybody was just distraught. He had become this popular figure. Irving Berlin even wrote a song about him.
Oh, he did?
Yes,
oh.
That's right. And the Queen gave him a special loving cup. He couldn't get the gold medal. Well, as if we needed more controversy, the guy who finished second was an American named Johnny Hayes, an Irish-American. And the Irish-Americans were furious at the British. This gets more complicated than we need to know, doesn't it? The Irish-Americans were furious at the British, and the British were then furious at the Americans, who had been winning all the track and field events. And poor Johnny Hayes, who'd done nothing but finish a respectable and honest second, was disparaged.
Oh,
and anti-American feelings ran high, and Pietri, on the other hand, was celebrated as the real winner, certainly the set of medal. And that remains to this day, I think, probably the most controversial finish in the Olympics, with the possible exception when Ben Johnson in Seoul was his gold medal in the 100 meters was taken away from him because he was found to have used drugs.
Mm. And you write in your piece that the special commissioner, James Sullivan, appointed by President Roosevelt to those Olympics where this happened, was convinced that the referees, who were all British, must be
yes.
homers. Was there truth in that? Were they?
Yeah. Sullivan, for which it's not that famous an award now, was for a long time, went to the top amateur athlete in the world, was named after this guy, James Sullivan, who was Teddy Roosevelt's, President Roosevelt's special chief envoy to the games, and he was a bit of a pain. 4 years later, he, for example, in Sweden, he would not let any of the American women swimmers and divers perform because he thought the bathing suits were too risky, risque.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So the poor women, you know, just this one guy's decision.
Oh.
Always been that way in the Olympics. These pompous jerks, you know, rule, and the poor athletes suffer. So anyway, he was claiming from the very beginning that the British were homers. And it was a mistake the British made to have all the officials be English.
Yeah.
That was a mistake, and it was corrected thereafter. Now referees come from not just the home country. But Sullivan, you know, was picayune, and just, he was looking for trouble, and he was, once again, Irish-American, and the Irish-Americans were furious because the British had required that the run under the Union Jack. They could not perform under the Irish flag. So there was a lot of anger to start with.
Oh, those uppity Irish Americans.
That's right.
Yeah, I know all about them.
With a name like Kathleen, I think
right.
You do.
Yeah, I do. And there's been some controversy. This is also a fascinating part of the story of dipping the flag to the Queen when the Olympics were held in London.
That's one of the great American, in the same breath as George Washington and the cherry tree. The story is as follows, and this is the story that all American schoolboys learn and is told every Olympics year, that as the opening parade passed by the Royal Box, this is in 1908, an American carrying the flag did not dip it as all the other countries did. And he was an Irish-American. And another Irish-American is supposed to have said afterwards that the red, white, and blue dips to no earthly king. And that thereafter, forever and ever, an American flag at the Olympics is never lowered while everybody else's is. Now, that's the myth. Well, some historians looked into that years later and found out that it's the myth. That indeed this one guy who was carrying the flag, a guy named Ralph Rose, he did on one occasion, there were apparently two occasions, on one occasion he did not dip the flag, but it's not clear why he didn't. He might have just forgotten. the quote that jingoistic, very melodramatic quote, "This flag dips to no earthly king," didn't appear till 1952, long after the guy who said it, or is supposed to have said it, was dead. There was no evidence in the newspapers at the time that the remark was made. And on the contrary, the paper said that the American contingent was welcomed with loud cheers. So it's just a good story, and it became encrusted, and there were times after that in which the flag did dip. It famously did not dip for Adolf Hitler in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the myth gained momentum, since the war, it has not been dipped. We couldn't possibly do it. As a matter of fact, during the war, there was a Congress passed a statute that the American flag could not dip to anybody outside of the United States, which sounds, I think, terribly overwrought to me. But maybe I'm not patriotic enough.
Frank DeFord is our guest this hour. We're talking about the Olympics and his very interesting article in the July-August issue of Smithsonian, The Little Known History of How the Modern Olympics Got Their Start. And lo and behold, it's because of England that they got their start, and a little town in England where there's another Olympics that's going on right now. Welcome to your phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. You also may have some special memories of certain Olympics. Some of those were fairly traumatic. I'm interested in hearing Frank bring us up to World War II and the London Olympics after London had been reduced to rubble. How do you do an Olympics with a city in that kind of condition? And here's how you reach us if you'd like, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and leave messages if you'd like on our Facebook page to The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of the show, David Marinitz. His latest book is Barack Obama, The Story. Frank DeFord is with us this hour, and we're talking about the Olympics, taking your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hello, Frank. I really enjoy listening to your commentaries in the morning, and I just wanted to ask if you know of any history of the Olympics preventing or starting any wars between countries?
The awards?
No, wars. Preventing or starting wars.
Oh, wars. Well, the myth is that the wars would end during the Greek Games, that they would stop the fighting. That's another overstatement. That really what happened is that if you were a spectator or a participant and a war was going on, you would be given safe passage to go to Olympia. But wars themselves were not concluded. It wasn't like, okay, the games are on, so we're going to stop fighting. It was simply safe passage was given. And I don't think there's any evidence at any time that any war was concluded. During the 1948 Olympics, for example, Greece was in the midst of a civil war, and it certainly didn't end just because the old Greek games were going on in London.
You also point to, I didn't remember this or didn't even know it, the Japanese government giving up the 1940 games because, as you write, they were otherwise occupied with killing and raping Chinese. The IOC simply decreed that the Winter Games would be returned to Germany because they'd been so swell there in 36. The decision was made in June of 39, only 3 months before the Nazis invaded Poland.
Let's call the people around the Olympics delusional. I think that's one thing. They like to believe that somehow they're not tainted at all by politics. And so, despite the fact that it was clear in 1939 that the Nazis were not nice people, they were perfectly willing to give the Winter Games back to the Germans simply because they'd run them so well in 1936. During Samarant's reign, he was always giving awards to people like the butcher of Romania. What was the guy's name? Ceausescu?
Mm-hmm.
He was given the highest Olympic award, just simply because he liked the Olympics. It didn't make any difference whether this was a terribly evil man who killed people and was a dictator. The head of the East German police was another guy who was awarded. In other words, if you liked the Olympics, you got an award. And they've always operated this way. Even Nazis were quickly forgiven after World War II and welcomed back into the bosom of the IOC. It's always pretended that it is this organization which is sort of insulated from the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And they call themselves a movement. You know, they're no more a movement than the National Football League is a movement. They're a bunch of games.
Mm-hmm.
They're fun and they're wonderful and we all love them and we enjoy them. And now they're a television show more than anything else.
Are they ever?
But they're called the Olympic Movement. Nobody explained quite what that means. And they really are sort of a pagan religion. I mean, if you see the open ceremony, it's replete with prayers and flags and doves are usually released. And,
yes.
And it's very much of a spiritual ceremony, at least parts of it.
Let's go to London after the city has been bombed, rubble all over, it's been leveled, and they're hosting an Olympics?
It was insane. The Olympics have always been run, going back to de Coubertin, by Europeans. It's very much dominated by Europeans, and is to this day. There was one American, Avery Brundage, who ran the Olympics for 20 years, who somehow managed to break the stranglehold of the Europeans, so he was very European-fied. But they wanted to have them in a European country after World War II, the same as they had them in Antwerp after World War I, which was, you know, a ridiculous place. I mean, that was close to the front lines that had been, you know, the carnage of World War I. Well, once again, this is sort of like we're not bothered by wars. We're better than wars. And the King George was delighted to have them, though. It was really his choice. He could have turned them down, but he saw this as a good thing, that ever his brother, the Prince of Wales, as king, it had been a tough time. It had been the Depression, and then it had been the war. And even after the war, England was really on its back. And rationing was still going on, serious rationing in 1948. But he thought, gee, at least something good. We can have something spectacular and glamorous here in England. And so they did have the 48 games somehow managed to have them. They were called the Austerity Games, which is interesting because we keep hearing the word austerity coming out of Europe today. But they were called the Austerity Games, and they were. And there was no Olympic Village. The athletes had to be put up in private homes and colleges and so forth. And the British population were still operating on they could only eat so many calories a day, rationed. The athletes were given a bonus. But turned out to be pretty popular games. The British warmed to them, and they were very successful and did, as a matter of fact, bring a certain amount of pride to the British, which had been so hard to find in those desperate times.
And the U.S. athletes, you write, had food really airlifted to them, didn't they?
Every day. Every day. Everything from chocolate bars to steaks, orange juice. And we did agree nicely that if anything was left over, it would go to the hospitals. And other countries also brought in food. But we, of course, had been, you know, barely touched by the war, not the homeland anyway. We lost a lot of soldiers, but we were otherwise fine. And we absolutely ruled the world. That was when that was just about the time the Marshall Plan started in 1948. The Berlin airlift was going on at that same time. I mean, the idea that wars were stopping was not quite true. And the Americans completely dominated the games because we had been able to, our athletes had been able to train. The other country that did fairly well was Sweden, which had been neutral during the war. All the other countries were hard-pressed. I remember talking to Roger Bannister, Sir Roger, who... The man who broke the four-minute mile a few years later and who carried the flag just last week. It was a lovely story. He carried the flag at Oxford where he broke the torch. And Bob Mathias was a young California schoolboy. He was only 17 years old, and he won the decathlon. And Bannister said, look, I'm not taking anything away from Mathias, he said, but it's impossible, inconceivable, that anybody from England or any other European country could have done what Mathias did at the age of 17 simply because we didn't have the nutrition.
Oh, interesting.
Couldn't diet. Nobody could have been that strong and healthy at the age of 17 if you'd, you know, gone through the horrors of of the war and the poverty.
Right.
And Americans, there was one other great athlete who did somehow rise above it all, a woman named Fanny Bankers Cohen, who was Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And she was probably, along with Matthias, the most prominent. She was a mother, and that was very rare at that time for a woman athlete to have had babies and still be an athlete. But generally speaking, the Americans dominated the games, but they were very, very successful.
Hmm. Well, we must go to 2012 for at least a moment. I have read somewhere that you're interested in watching a couple things. You're interested in Michael Phelps because this could be his swan song.
Yes, he says it will be. And this time, he has a real rival in Ryan Lochte.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be very special. The swimming is always invariably the first week. And Phelps before, it was always sort of Phelps against the field. And now it's Phelps versus Lochte. And I think it always is more dramatic when it's a head-to-head competition. And so he's not going for 8 medals. He's only going for 7.
Oh, goodness.
but it will be amazing to see if he can rise to the occasion again. And so I'll certainly be watching that. I think it takes a little of the edge off of it that both of them are Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The Olympics were at their best when we were fighting the evil empire, right?
I guess
but
so.
Us versus those nasty Soviets, right. Like that great ice hockey game.
Right, right. We'll forever remember that.
But at least we get head-to-head competition.
Yeah, and the other one you're looking at, particularly, you're looking at the whole thing, I know, Usain Bolt's.
Yes. Yeah, as the caller mentioned earlier, this is a guy who holds the world's record, and he's almost freakish.
Hmm.
But he's got a lot of competition, and there's some question whether he's at the peak of his powers. But the 100-meter dash is always the premier track event, So there'll be, no matter who was running, there'd be attention. But with Usain Bolt, the world record holder, that'll be even more special. Of course, the weather being so bad.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it?
And I understand the long range forecast isn't much better. They suffered so through Wimbledon, and that would reduce. You know, if the weather's bad, the chances of a record would be reduced considerably in the cold, heavy air.
Yeah. You talked about the opening ceremonies taking on almost an aspect of being spiritual. What about the Olympics themselves, Frank? What's it like to be... there is a spiritual element when I watch this. I can get teary-eyed watching, you know, whatever flag it is, whoever wins. There's something just so extraordinary about the whole event. Do you feel that when you're there? Is it the hope for all humankind somewhere on display every day?
I think that's an overstatement. I do think there is certainly, I'm not trying to be cynical now, because there's certainly a sense of fellowship and that we are putting the real world behind us, but it rears its ugly head pretty quickly. And the other thing is there is so much international sport now. I mean, that the Olympics are not as unique as they used to be. They're champions. They're international championships in every sport. And because of airplanes, athletes are flying all around the world and competing all the time. We just had the European Cup Soccer Championship, which Spain won again. And many people will tell you that Europeans were more interested in that than they will be in the Olympics. So they're not as special as they used to be, and it's also sort of an irony that the events that are the most famous, which at the Olympics, the ones that receive the most attention, the swimming and track, pretty much disappear once the Olympics are over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like cicadas. They only pop up every 4 years. And so people's attention is more, as we talked earlier, on team sports. That's not to say that there isn't some aura of good feeling that you do find at the Olympics. And there's always some wonderful stories. Somebody from a little country wins a gold medal, or wins the first medal that the country's had. Or, I mean, there are lovely stories that do pop up, and then there are also horrible stories where somebody cheats and somebody's caught using drugs, and it's just another athletic competition. So it's sort of a hybrid. You know, the whole idea of playing the national anthem of the winner is kind of anathema to what the Olympics are supposed to be about.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, there's not supposed to be any nationalism, and yet it's rife with nationalism. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain amount of contradiction or hypocrisy that is there. The movement is not always a movement. Sometimes it's just out-and-out competition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Frank, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kathleen, I've enjoyed talking to you.
Frank DeFord, our guest, we thank him for being with us. And if you're looking for his article, it's really a fascinating piece because he's such a fine writer. It's the little-known history of how the modern Olympics got their start, and it currently appears in the Smithsonian Magazine. That's the July-August issue. Frank is... written a number of books. We had him on most recently talking about Overtime, My Life as a Sports Writer. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks for your interest in the hour, everybody. We have news coming up, and we'll return with another hour. Stay with us. It's about Barack Obama.